Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is the son of one of Hollywood's most beloved and respected actors, Don DeFore, who appeared in dozens of great movies, including A Guy Named Joe, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, The Male Animal, Ramrod, Romance on the High Seas, The Facts of Life, and one of the great Christmas classics, It Happened on Fifth Avenue. He worked with everyone from Spencer Tracy and Lionel Barrymore to John Wayne, Henry Fonda, Robert Mitchum, Olivia de Havilland, Claudette Colbert, Lucille Ball, Judy Holliday, and that's just scratching the surface. On television, he became a household name, first as Mr. Thornberry, or Thorny, the next-door neighbor on The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, earning him a 1954 Emmy nomination for Best Supporting Actor. And then he became Mr. Baxter, affectionately referred to as Mr. B, for four seasons on the classic sitcom Hazel, co-starring the wonderful Shirley Booth. Don DeFore's acting was seamless, because he was projecting his genuine, regular guy personality that made him endearing, enduring, and beloved by his millions of fans. But there was much more to this man than his acting career. He was a loving husband to big band singer Marion Holmes and a devoted father to his five children. He owned a popular barbecue restaurant at Disneyland. He served on the board of the Screen Actors Guild and was president of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and he orchestrated the first nationally televised Emmy Awards show in 1955. In 1965, he co-authored a book with his sister Penny DeFore entitled With All My Love, about her experiences working in a Korean orphanage. He has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He was part of the U.S. delegation to the 1969 International Film Festival in Moscow. And after getting to know Ronald Reagan on the set of a movie they made together, he became heavily involved in President Reagan's political career and was on the Presidential Advisory Committee to the Peace Corps. And if that weren't enough, Don DeFore was a very gifted furniture maker. Our guest has had a remarkable life himself. He started out in the television industry and then moved on to an impressive career in Washington, first in the Peace Corps, then as part of President Reagan's administration, and then as co-founder of one of the largest and most respected public affairs firms in Washington. He's here to talk about his wonderful book, Growing Up in Disneyland, Memoirs of Stage, TV, and Movie Star Don DeFore, and his son's exciting life in a celebrity family and beyond. I'm delighted to welcome Ron DeFore to our show. Ron, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Harvey, for having me and letting me share some of the stories with your audience.
Ron, your book includes portions of your father's unpublished autobiography entitled Hollywood, DeFore, and After. Why was his memoir never published?
Well, the short answer is because he kept on writing it. He worked on it for 20 years, but because of his life and with so many things that he was involved with, he would wind up adding another chapter about whatever that involvement was. I once said to family members that, you know, I hope it never ends, because I somehow have a feeling that his life on this planet is directly connected to his need to keep on working on the book. And sadly, he finished the book in October of 1993, and he passed away in December of 1993. So he never had the chance to get it published.
Well, I love the fact that you've included so many portions of the book in your book. Now, Ron, I've interviewed many children of Hollywood stars, and they've all told me that being the child of a celebrity is nowhere near as glamorous as it sounds. Do you agree?
Well, it's a different experience for each one of them. Certainly those that actually were child actors and worked in it, and their parents, a good friend of mine is in that exact situation, Peter Ackerman, whose father produced a number of the 1950s, 1960s sitcoms. He had somewhat of a normal life, normal in quotes, because we've met and we've shared stories and everything, and our lives have been, you know, I can't say normal, but not as wild and disappointing as many others in the Hollywood world.
You grew up in Brentwood and you went to school with the children of many big stars. As you know, Ron, some children from very rich families, including two of your childhood friends, were very spoiled and overindulged and had tragic lives as adults. But you never fell into that trap because your parents tried to give you as normal a childhood as possible. Did you appreciate that at the time?
Good question. No. I was surrounded by a number of children of people in the business. And you're right, many of them were very wealthy. And unfortunately, their parents just gave them anything for whatever they asked for. And my example that I use in the book is, you know, when I got into playing guitar, I had to convince my parents first I was going to take guitar lessons and make it worthwhile spending money on a guitar. And then I had to pay them back. I borrowed the money and paid them back. And again, yeah, that was hard to take as a teenager when all my friends, all they had to do is snap their fingers and they would get whatever they want. But the day I moved out, when I was 18 and I moved out of the house and had to survive on my own, shortly thereafter, it really hit me like a ton of bricks that thank God that my parents brought me up the way that I did because I was able to survive.
Yeah, I know. I read in your book you had to do chores to get a weekly allowance and you even had a lemonade stand as a kid. So although your childhood wasn't as extravagant as some of the other children of big stars, you did have some extraordinary experiences like getting to meet the Beatles in 1964 at a private party in Brentwood. What do you remember of that day?
I remember a lot because it was certainly a special event for us, although I must say it's nowhere as big an event as it is when I look back on it, when I was writing the book about it and rethinking, really, this was so much bigger than I really realized at the time. Getting to meet the Beatles during their first tour of the U.S. is beyond comprehension. But again, we got to do so many wonderful things that it was just kind of another neat thing. So I remember it well. I was the only person to have an 8mm camera there, so I'm the only one that has moving pictures because the media was not allowed in that event. I'm the only one that has moving pictures of that private party.
As I mentioned in my introduction, your dad owned a restaurant concession at Disneyland called Don DeFore's Silver Banjo Barbecue Restaurant. I loved reading about your efforts to surreptitiously put up a plaque at Disneyland on the spot where the restaurant used to be. That was like an episode of I Love Lucy, don't you think?
Yeah, that's funny. That, yeah, very much like Lucy. And we had a lot of fun putting up that plaque surreptitiously. In fact, I did it 3 times because they didn't last forever. Somebody in security obviously saw it and took it down, but we put it back up 3 times.
I think you're amazing. You know, when I reviewed your father's movie career, I was amazed at how many great movies he was in. I really loved him in Ramrod, which was the first film noir Western. Your dad played Bill Shell. Was that one of his favorite roles?
It is. Very perceptive of you. It's my favorite character that he played and my brother's favorite character. It's just different than so many of the other characters that he played. And I think he did a really good job.
Your father co-starred in The Facts of Life with Bob Hope and Lucille Ball. Did he ever tell you what it was like working with Lucy?
I don't have any memories of him directly telling me about that, so I can't really elaborate on that. I guess the best test of all is that I don't recall him saying anything negative. So I can only assume that he enjoyed working with him, and I think he did a great job in his part in that film.
Do you think your father has been adequately recognized for his work in movies, or has all of that been overshadowed by his work on TV?
Another good question. You know, I've been running a Facebook group for my dad for more than 20 years, the Don DeFore Fan Club. It's got close to 2,500 members, and it's really heartwarming to wake up almost every day and take a look at the latest comments people have had. That is one of the most common comments, is that Don DeFore was highly underrated, or is highly underrated. And I believe that to be true. And I remember we didn't really speak of it in those terms when he was still alive, but we all kind of thought that it's, you know, a shame he didn't get a certain part, or a lot didn't happen after Hazel. Although I must say, I think it's about 20 guest appearances, somewhere around 20, that he did between 1963 and 1980. So it wasn't like he was sitting around doing nothing.
Your father worked with some of the greatest directors. He made at least three movies with Mervyn LeRoy, and he worked with Victor Fleming, Michael Curtiz, Raoul Walsh, and John Farrow, just to name a few. Did he have a favorite director?
No, he didn't. In my opinion, he was such a well-studied actor, because all of his background was started in junior high and plays, and then he went to the Pasadena Playhouse School for acting, which was, you know, one of the best in the world. So I think he knew his trade so well that he probably didn't need a lot of direction. Certainly every actor, no matter how good they are, needs some direction. But I don't recall him, you know, picking out any one director. Oh, I know that he was not happy with the director of Hazel, and I'll leave it at that.
Now you're going to leave us hanging wondering why.
He just didn't like the director, and thought that in some cases he felt it was abuse. Different things with his dressing room and, you know, things that were going on. But some of those things I chose not to put in the book, because, you know, I just don't like a lot of negative stuff about my dad. Dad was a pretty special person, and I didn't think it was important to put that in the book.
But on the other hand, the fact that when you watch the show now, you see such great acting, you see him being so comfortable and so happy. Now that I know that he actually wasn't all that happy because of the director, it makes me admire your father even more.
Well, yes. I can't add anything to that. Yes, he was able to work through some conditions that some actors probably wouldn't want to tolerate. The thing that helped too with Hazel is that he and Shirley Booth were extremely close. They were great. Even when they weren't shooting, they'd be off in the corner on the set studying their lines or just chatting. And Shirley always had her little pet poodle there, and he knew his trade.
Yeah, he was a real pro, and the chemistry between your father and Shirley Booth was magical.
It was. And again, I attribute a lot of that to their relationship. They loved each other. I've got letters between both of them that certainly underscore that point.
Ron, you wrote that when you were a kid, you were not a fan of the Hazel show because you didn't think it was cool. Has your opinion of the show changed as you got older?
No. It's funny. I just shocked one of my many wonderful, or my dad's wonderful fans on the Facebook, when they were asking me, they actually gave the series year and episode number and asked me a question about something that happened in that. And I said, I hope I'm not offending you, but I must tell you that I have not seen most of the episodes of Hazel, even though I've got the entire DVD set. I just don't have a burning desire to do that.
Well, I watched it all. I watched it when it was on TV when I was a kid, and I've seen it since, and I just loved it. I think it's reminiscent of a time that no longer exists. And to be honest, I was one of those kids that wished we had a housekeeper like Hazel when I was growing up.
That's a common comment as well that I get. I've even gotten a throwback from my wife every once in a while, and she says, I'm not your Hazel.
Your book really gave us a sense of who your dad was. For example, he wrote about a brief but sweet encounter he had with a very young Marilyn Monroe at a promotional event in New York. And I could tell from what your dad wrote that it was very important to him to always be respectful and professional, even in the presence of the most glamorous female stars. He really was a gentleman, wasn't he?
Yeah, he really was. And I must say that I had never really read that episode of from his writing until I started doing the book. And that whole section, I read it and I said, there's no way this can't be in the book. As you say, it really demonstrated his character of being a strong Christian, moral, un-Hollywood type person. And that's one of the most important points I tried to get out in the book, is that's why I thank God I'm alive, is that my parents were that way. And they were very un-Hollywood. They weren't part of the Hollywood crowd. The parties they had maybe two or three different well-known people, but most of them were friends from the church or other groups that my dad belonged to.
It's quite amazing. He was a professional and he was a gentleman. And another thing about him that I have to mention, Ron, your dad really loved his fans, and he would even go speak to them when the tour buses stopped in front of your house. That says so much about the kind of person he was, don't you think?
Absolutely. It's just one more example of him being quite different. And I, whenever I get into this discussion about him and his fans and stuff, I often think of the opposite situation when my dad took my younger sister to a Dodger game, and Paul Newman was sitting right near them. And so my sister Amy said, oh, I want to go up and get his autograph. He was so rude to my sister, and she started crying because he didn't want, he said something like, hey, I'm here to watch a baseball game. You know, get out of here, kid. You bother me, you know. And I always held that in my mind because that's the opposite of my dad. My dad knew that all of his successes are directly due to his fans. You can't be a successful performer if nobody likes you, you know? And then the other thing is he was a storyteller, and he loved telling stories and chatting with people. And that's the way he was. So I used to laugh when he'd, walk out to the bus, but that was my dad.
That's very disappointing about Paul Newman. I'd never heard that before.
Well, I didn't put that in the book. Many things like that I don't put in the book because that's just my own experience with my sister. I have no idea. He might have been totally gracious with everybody else, but my dad did say to my sister that it didn't surprise him.
That's telling. I want to ask you now about your father's involvement in politics and specifically the Republican Party. Most people in the entertainment industry were Democrats, weren't they?
Yes, indeed. And some of them, like my dad and Reagan, were Democrats prior to becoming Republicans.
Did you think that being an active and well-known Republican affected your father's career?
I don't think so. So that's been suggested, but you can easily point to a number of conservative or Republican actors or actresses that did very well with their careers. And I would say that my dad did very, very well, too. It's hard to prove a negative. It's hard to prove that he would have perhaps gotten some bigger roles if he hadn't been dabbling in politics. But you don't know.
What would your dad think of the political situation today in America?
Oh, I think he'd be as upset as all of us, Democrat and Republican. I have spent the last 20 years myself in my business surrounded by politics. I haven't done politics, but I would say what I think he thinks or would think right now, and that is that at least 20, 30 years ago, you could get things passed that are truly bipartisan. That's almost impossible today because everything is so polarized.
I want to ask you now a bit about your own life. In the book, you've made numerous references to yourself as Forrest Gump. Why?
Actually, I'm glad I did that because I've since talked to two or three other sons of celebrities who have actually used that same term themselves. It's just because of this, so many wonderful, amazing things, not just for me, but amazing things in history I was next to or a part of. And I'm not comparing myself to anybody else. I think I mentioned something very early in the book that there are sons and daughters of celebrities that I'm sure had far more amazing experiences than I do, but I can only tell my story. And that's how ever since that film came out, I not only connected with that main theme of being around so many important things in history, but I equate my entire career to the feather that you see at the very beginning that's just kind of floating with the air, and it's at the end of the film too. And I said, that's me. It never had any plan in my career path. I just went where the winds were blowing, and unfortunately it blew in some pretty nice directions.
Well, one of those pretty nice directions was in 1986, you were the PR man for the Beach Boys at their Live Aid performance in Philadelphia. Tell us about that experience.
Well, I was director of public affairs for the Peace Corps during that period. And 1986 was also the 25th anniversary of the Peace Corps. So I was coordinating a year-long 32-city tour for the director of the Peace Corps to do a number of celebratory events. And backing it up a little bit before we started all that, I was at one of the Reagan inaugural balls and ran into Mike Love. And it surprised me that he was even a Republican, but he is. He's very conservative. And we got to talking, and I was mentioning what I was doing for the Peace Corps' 25th anniversary. And he said, well, wait a minute, what year is that anniversary? I said, 1986. And he says, that's the 25th anniversary of the Beach Boys. I said, wow, that'd be great if we could do some things. So nothing ever became of that other than probably about a dozen meetings that I had with Mike over that year. When he would fly into D.C., we'd get together. What we were trying to do is produce a series of Beach Boy concerts in some of the key Peace Corps countries. And it just, the logistics just got away from us. We never got to do that. But part of that process was him calling me at home one day. And he says, have you heard of this Live Aid concert? Oh, I said, sure, yeah, absolutely. There's going to be a billion people watching. He said, well, you know, we're part of that. Would you like to fly up with me and the boys to be a part of that and do my PR for that day? I said, yeah, you got it. I'm there. So there wasn't a lot of PR for me to do other than, you know, coordinating a few backstage interviews. There was a point where he put me in the bus with Brian Wilson for about a half an hour. So it was just me and Brian for a half an hour. That was pretty incredible.
I can't resist mentioning that you were partly responsible for launching the career of one of my all-time favorite comedians, Foster Brooks. Tell me about that.
Oh, Foster. Yeah, he and I became very good friends after that. Well, this was when I was the associate director on the Steve Allen Show. It was a very small staff. We all had about half a dozen duties besides our key duty. One of mine was collecting all of the stuff that was sent in by various agents to try and get their client on Steve Allen's show. And we had an extra room outside of the office where I used it to store all this stuff. And one day I went to the producer. I said, there are some really good things that we could mine in all this stuff here. There's probably some great talent, and we're running out of room. So I either need to just throw all this stuff away, or we need to have a day for auditions. And so he decided we would have a day of auditions. So the day of audition, I'm there with the clipboard. I'm checking off people, sending them up in the bleachers so that we have everybody ready to go for Steve and us to watch. And the one guy that comes in, you know, he looks and says, I'm Foster Brooks. And he seemed to be totally smashed. He says, I'm here, you know, I arranged for the audition. And Rocco Urbici, the one of the co-producers, was standing right next to me. He pulled me aside. He said, we're not doing this. I don't want to turn this into, you know, a big circus. And this guy is obviously smashed. And I said, no. His agent, I can't remember who the agent was, but it was somebody that also handled some big names like Bill Cosby. And you can't snuff a good agent like that, because then you won't get any of their people. So I said, we got to do this one. And he says, well, okay, put him all the way in the back. We're going to do everybody first, get them out of here, and then you can let him do whatever he's going to do. And we did that, and he came up, stumbled down the stairs, and came to the microphone and said, I'm sorry, but I thought the audition was tomorrow. Hiccup. You know? And we were dying. We were standing over on the side of the stage, and we were just so embarrassed. But Rocco looks at me and says, it's kind of the look like, now, aren't you glad we waited till the last to have this guy on? But he went on for like 30 seconds. And as what would happen with all of his appearances, after 30 seconds, you realize that this is the guy's gig. And so Rocco was eventually on the floor. He literally was on the floor laughing and still hearing Foster go on. So Rocco gets up and he says, we're putting him on with Bill Cosby next week, and I'll figure out somehow. And so we did. We had him on with Bill, and had him on as his sixth grade basketball coach. You know, like, he's not going to remember who that is. And Bill Cosby did the same thing. He didn't know whether to laugh or cry. The director did a great job of shots back and forth between Foster and Bill. And eventually Bill did what we all did. About 30 seconds later, he realized it was a gag. And he too slid off of Steve's couch and was rolling on the floor. It was a wonderful experience. And Foster and I became great friends. And shortly thereafter, he became a regular on The Cosby Show.
Oh, he was so remarkably talented because he was hysterical. Did he drink in real life?
He's a former drinker. That helps, because you know how to act. But the sad thing is that his type of humor went out of style like a lead balloon as soon as Mothers Against Drunk Drivers was formed. And I'm real familiar with MAD because I worked at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration on drunk driving and all kinds of highway safety stuff. And it was very clear that that's what killed him. And he knew it too. We would talk about it, because back in the 70s, you could still laugh at a drunk. Starting in the early 80s, that was no more longer fashionable.
That's really sad. I never connected Mothers Against Drunk Driving to Foster Book's career kind of ending. That's actually very sad.
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting social phenomenon, but it didn't die completely. As you may know, he went on for, God, a couple decades, I think, at least, in doing Vegas shows. So in Vegas, it was still somewhat acceptable.
Now, Ron, you actually turned down an offer to be associate director of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. Why?
Okay. Now, that would take a couple hours of full description, but I'll shorten it. After I left KTLA-TV and the Steve Allen Show, I had gotten consumed into this multi-level marketing thing. And again, I won't go into the details, but it was very intense. It was turned out to be a Ponzi scheme, but we didn't know it. But they had a lot of training that went on with it, and they trained us to never work for anybody else again. Always be a sole proprietor, the captain of your own ship. And, you know, that was pounded into us. Now, the thing failed, but halfway in between, when I was, you know, really loving doing that stuff with my partner, I got a call from a guy named Loring Dussault. Loring is no longer with us, but he had been the executive producer of the Steve Allen Show. And he said, hi, Ron, you know, you may not know, I'm over here in Burbank, head of programming. And did you hear that the Carson Show is moving out from New York to Burbank? And I said, yeah, I heard something about that. And he said, well, from what I understand, one of the only people on the staff not coming out here is the associate director. Would you like a shot? And I said, Loring, I appreciate it, but I'm now the captain of my own ship. And I went on to say, thank you very much, but you know, I'm doing my own thing now. So everybody has a fork in the road in their life. This was probably my biggest.
Are you sorry that you didn't take the job?
That's always tough to say. You know, I go back and forth. I mean, I've discussed that with my wife 100 times probably, that, you know, had I done that, I wouldn't have met her. I wouldn't have my 2 wonderful kids and my 3 wonderful grandchildren. I mean, so it's tough to know what would have happened, you know. I do miss being in the television business. I must say that. If I were asked out of the 20-odd careers that I've had, if you could have a time machine, go back in your favorite position, I've always said it would be being on the Steve Allen Show staff again. That was heaven.
It was in your blood, Ron.
I think it was.
Well, Ron, I want you to just sit back and listen to some of the experiences you've had in your life. Just listen to this. As a child, you got to meet the Beatles. You met scores of big stars, including people like Jonathan Winters, who came to your house for dinner. You got to be an extra on Ozzy and Harriet and Hazel, and you appeared on Art Linkletter's show, Kids Say the Darndest Things. And you basically had free reign at Disneyland. In fact, you and your sister, Dawn, rode in the same car with Walt Disney in the Disneyland Christmas Parade. You grew up living in the same neighborhood as people like Dick Van Dyke, Robert Mitchum, Lauren Green, Steve McQueen, Esther Williams. You were the onstage photographer at a Led Zeppelin concert. You got to spend 30 minutes alone with Robin Williams before a show. And when you worked briefly as a real estate agent in Encino, you showed a house to Michael Jackson. And you held 3 prestigious positions in President Reagan's administration. So, Ron, I just have to ask you, are there times you have to pinch yourself to believe the life you've had?
Well, I haven't pinched myself, but I wrote a book. And that's really the culmination of what you just laid out there. I've done a number of presentations, mostly to Disney enthusiasts, but about the Silver Banjo restaurant that we had. But we've done so many that my brother and I, when we do these presentations, I say, you know, we got to add some other things in our lives to, you know, keep this presentation fresh. So we started adding a lot of the things I have in the book. And after every presentation, there was always a few people that said, God, you got to write a book. And so the book is the culmination of all of those stories and many, many people saying, you gotta memorialize this, put this down in writing, and adding and realizing that I had my dad's unpublished manuscript on my computer was just a wonderful bonus for me to go, I could write a book not only about myself, but both my dad and I, and a lot of the unusual things that we were blessed in having.
Well, writing the book was brilliant because those stories would have been lost if you had not preserved them. These are part of the historical record of show business. And I don't know, if it was me, I would have to pinch myself to believe that I've done all those things.
Well, here, I'll do it right now.
There you go.
I felt it.
I want to tell our viewers that you can learn more about Dawn DeFore by going to the official fan club website, defore.net, which is dedicated to honoring Dawn DeFore's career and body of work. You can also join the Dawn DeFore fan club Facebook page, and you can follow Ron DeFore on his own Facebook page and subscribe to Ron DeFore's YouTube channel. Now, Ron, you've also created a new Facebook group called My Celebrity Family. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's surprising that it took me 20 years of running the fan page for my dad to think of this idea, but I realized that there's a number of people like me that are, you know, family of well-known people, and many of these people I've come to know, and I thought, there's really no one place for all those people to gather and then for others to view and watch that conversation and even comment and ask questions. There really was no Facebook page that I'm aware of that provided that. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to try that. I got to know how to create a group and promote it. And it's amazing. Out of the several groups I run, the membership has grown faster than any other one. I think it's up to close to 400 members now.
Well, one of the most popular features of our show is our Gone But Not Forgotten series, where I interview children like you of famous stars. We've had the daughter of Errol Flynn. We've had the son of Hedy Lamarr. We've had Boris Karloff's daughter was on very recently. So I should really join that Facebook group and ask some of these children of famous stars to come on my show, because the fans really want to hear from the family what these iconic legendary stars were really like.
I agree with you, and I welcome you. I'd love to have you part of that. I've got two other people that I've done podcasts with that had similar interests, that they want to see some of the family of stars that might join, so they might have access to them as well. Please, I'd love to have you join.
I'm going to do it. I can't wait. Well, Ron, I only have one more question for you. I'm sorry, but I just can't resist asking you this question. You had the chance to attend Karen Carpenter's wedding and you didn't go. What were you thinking?
I've asked myself that same question in the same tone. I have no idea. I really don't know. I know where I was and what I was doing. Lori and I had just gotten married. We were living out in the valley. I can't imagine that there was something so pressing that would have kept me from that. But yeah, it was actually an invitation to my parents, and they couldn't go. They were going to be out of the country or something. But they said, hey, you know, why don't you guys respond? You can go on our behalf. So I don't know the answers to that.
Well,
we've all done a lot of dumb things in our life, and that's one of them.
Well, the marriage didn't last, so I suppose that's some consolation. Well, Ron, it's been such a pleasure having this opportunity to celebrate your dear father's life and career. And I'm so happy you wrote your wonderful book. I cannot recommend it highly enough. I absolutely loved it. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Harvey, if I can add one last thing. Right now, there is a hiccup with my publisher. So if I can urge anybody interested in learning more about the book, buying an autographed copy of the book, you need to go to growingupindisneyland.com. That's the place where you get the book and get an autographed copy of the book.
All right. So everyone, I highly recommend this book. Go to growingupindisneyland.com to get a copy of the wonderful book by our guest, Ron DeFore. The book is entitled Growing Up in Disneyland. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to our producer, Steve Silver, my wonderful management team, Rick and Robin at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.